Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. As the deadline approaches for getting health insurance, learn what it's like to go through the process.
03-21-1990.
A Kentucky basketball great is in a West Virginia federal prison.
I want to say to the people of the state how sorry that I am.
A new school in Cabell County, West Virginia could be a model for the rest of the state.
What you should see in a classroom like this is more student engagement, a high level of student engagement.
And meet Joe Riley, a Pocahontas County, West Virginia farmer.
Whenever I was a kid, Dad had this farm.
And these stories and more are coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Kentucky Congressman Hal Rogers and Governor Steve Beshear have announced the creation of a 15-member executive committee to lead their SOAR, or Shaping Our Appalachian Region, initiative. Rogers and the governor will co-chair the panel, which will be composed of public officials and leaders from the private sector. The congressman says the group will keep listening to ideas to boost the region's economy and improve its quality of life. However, he stresses it will also get things done.
I believe in results, not conversation. Well, conversation's okay if you're talking about basketball games. But when you're talking about the future of our region, we want action.
Governor Beshear says the newly formed SOAR Executive Committee will not be working alone on the challenges facing Eastern Kentucky. He says it'll have plenty of help.
Also today, we're announcing the creation of 10 working groups, which will be responsible for leading discussions throughout the region on topics related to Eastern Kentucky's future well-being and quality of life.
Beshear says those groups will include panels on business recruitment and worker training, education, broadband expansion, healthcare, and tourism. One of the executive committee's first tasks will be hiring a permanent director, which it hopes to do by September. SOAR was created to help Eastern Kentucky recover from the slump in the coal industry and the loss of thousands of jobs. The deadline to sign up for health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act is swiftly approaching. Monday is the deadline for signing up without facing a tax penalty. But the Obama administration gave some flexibility to those who have their online applications started by then. West Virginia Public Radio's Ashton Mara wanted to know, how difficult is it to sign up for a health care plan? She visited a navigator to help her with the process and files this report.
I apologize. Hello? Is she here or on the phone? Can you take a message and I'll call her back?
I met Michelle Bays at her office in East Huntington. She's a certified application counselor for Valley Health, hired to help people navigate the complex federal health care exchange and state Medicaid application in order to meet the deadline, a deadline that's quickly approaching.
Unfortunately, the deadline's the 31st.
The 31st. That's this coming Monday. But the federal government has recently extended that deadline in a way, giving individuals who have at least signed up for an account and begun the process until April 15th to complete their applications and choose a new health plan. Michelle says plenty of people are rushing to meet that deadline. She's seen an uptick in the number of people in her office in the past week and had to deal with longer wait times when she calls the federal call center. So I asked Michelle to do what she does for those seeking coverage. Show me the process. Help me fill out an application. But here's where I'll throw out a disclaimer. I'm a state employee. I have a qualified health plan and don't need insurance. But still, I wanted to know, what options are out there for someone like me, the ideal candidate for the federal government? 24 years old, no chronic illnesses or pre-existing conditions. I am the person they want to sign up through the exchange. So I gave Michelle my information. A few keystrokes later, I had an account, and we started.
Date of birth?
03-21-1990.
social?
Well, that one I probably shouldn't share on the radio. But Michelle says when you go to visit a navigator or sign up on your own, all you need is some basic information. The number of people in your household, along with their birth dates and social security numbers. A pay stub or a W-2 to verify your household income. Possibly a form from your employer if they offer insurance and you're opting out. None of this, Michelle says, should intimidate you.
Yes, it's very minimal. It's very easy.
So easy, she successfully walked 300 people through the process since October. But Michelle was walking me through the federal health care exchange. In West Virginia, just fewer than 15,000 people have used the website, call center, or in-person assisters to gain coverage. That's pretty low compared to many other states. The real story in West Virginia is Medicaid expansion.
So as of last Friday, we have 101,803 individuals enrolled in the Medicaid expansion.
That's Jeremiah Samples, assistant to the Secretary of the State Department of Health and Human Resources. It's his job to keep track of those numbers, which well exceed the 60-some thousand estimate actuaries thought would sign up for Medicaid through the state expansion. In order to get those numbers, Sample says the state took an auto-enrollment approach, sending out letters to people on food stamps or whose children already qualify for Medicaid, among other assistance programs. The letters basically said, according to the information the state has on your income, you are now eligible for Medicaid, and asked them to check a box to agree to be signed up. Simple, easy, streamlined, as Samples put it, avoiding the technological issues they knew would arise.
It was anticipated that there were going to be some issues that would come up with the technology. This was all rushed to production, and there was not a lot of testing, especially on the federal side. They failed to test major systems leading up to the enrollment or the coverage enrollment process, open enrollment process. And as a result, we knew that there was going to be a high risk there. And so when we did this, it was with that in mind.
Sample says the state has enrolled 77% of the population they estimate is eligible for Medicaid. He says that's a great success for the state. Perry Bryant, on the other hand, says the state could have done more.
Well, it's been a very mixed bag for West Virginia.
Bryant is the executive director of the advocacy group West Virginians for Affordable Health Care, and he agrees. The Medicaid numbers are great for the state. But he says when the governor's office chose to partner with the federal government on the exchange, they chose to leave the advertising up to them as well, leaving federal dollars on the table that could have been used for television or radio ads. That hurt the exchange numbers, Bryant says.
We've been handicapped in that effort, but still there have been a lot of people who have been engaged. There's been a lot of personal assistance. There just hasn't been the media campaign, and you really need the combination of the two. And so we've been fighting this battle with one arm behind our back.
But as the deadline inches closer, he thinks the numbers will improve. After all, 6 million Americans have already signed up. Michelle, our Huntington-based assister, agrees. She thinks those numbers will grow as long as people take a look at the options for themselves.
You need to apply on your own and get an idea for yourself as to whether or not this is affordable. Don't listen to someone else's opinion, because it can be totally different for that individual. And I'm afraid a lot of people may say, you know, I'm going to take the penalty just because of something that they've heard from a neighbor.
As for me, I had 13 options, with monthly premiums ranging from $175 to almost $300. Pretty decent, since West Virginia has only one insurance provider signed up in the marketplace. But Bryant says the options are better for many West Virginians out there whose life stats are different than mine, for people who are married, have kids, or have medical conditions that prevented them from getting coverage before. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
As the deadline for signing up for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act approaches, audiences in the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia are getting the opportunity to view the issue of health care through the one-man play, Mercy Killers. The main character in Mercy Killers is Joe. He's from Southeast Ohio, works as an auto mechanic, and is libertarian in his political views. The man who wrote and performs the play, Juilliard-educated stage actor Michael Milligan, was inspired by a real-life experience. Milligan says when he was younger, he had health insurance but had not given much thought to the issue of medical care. Then he was in a relationship with someone who needed a lot of care.
It was thrust upon me, the reality of how difficult it is for many people to get the care that they need. And it became apparent to me that artists as a demographic are a group that have been marginalized by the healthcare system.
In the play, Joe's wife has cancer and loses her health insurance, and the couple struggles with paying for the treatment she needs. Milligan has done readings of Mercy Killers and has performed it steadily for a little over a year now in several states and at the Edinburgh Festival in Scotland, where it won the Fringe First Award for New Plays. All the while, the heated national debate over the Affordable Care Act and its implementation raged on.
I remember during that weekend, you know, when the shutdown was happening, which was about Obamacare, I was performing it in an open garage in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, sort of spilling over into the sidewalk on a Saturday night as people were walking by, going to meet their friends at bars and stuff. I was there kind of doing it in the open air, and people stopped and listened and, you know, really got the sense that, oh, this debate is still going on, you know. And so that was interesting.
Milligan says the play doesn't take a position on Obamacare, but tries to remind people about why something had to be done to address problems in the healthcare system.
I think it's important as we as the discussion continues, that people reflect and remember back, oh, this was why this happened. Yeah, people losing their insurance at the moment they need it most was really a immoral condition that was going on.
Milligan is performing Mercy Killers in Morgan, Berkeley, and Jefferson counties of West Virginia through Wednesday. For a list of shows, visit our website, wvpublic.org. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. In Kentucky, a Franklin County judge has ruled the law doesn't allow the use of eminent domain for a natural gas liquids pipeline. As Kentucky Public Radio's Erica Peterson reports, this is the latest blow to the controversial Bluegrass Pipeline project.
The Bluegrass Pipeline would carry natural gas liquids across Kentucky to the Gulf of Mexico. The NGLs are used in manufacturing processes, but the project has been controversial because of worries about environmental impact and safety concerns. A measure to block NGL pipelines from using eminent domain is moving through the state legislature, but the Franklin County ruling adds another legal hurdle to the project. Judge Philip Shepard ruled the pipeline doesn't fall under the Commonwealth's definition of public service, and thus couldn't use eminent domain. Tom Fitzgerald of the Kentucky Resources Council filed the lawsuit on behalf of several local landowners.
Certainly having this decision is helpful because it sends a message to landowners that they don't need to negotiate out of fear. They can negotiate out of a voluntary intent.
A spokesman for the companies behind the Bluegrass Pipeline say they will appeal the ruling. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Erica Peterson.
As the University of Kentucky Wildcats prepared for the NCAA basketball tournament this past week, one of the most popular players from UK's storied past reported to federal prison. Richie Farmer is serving a 27-month sentence at the United States Penitentiary Hazleton in West Virginia. The former Kentucky Agriculture Commissioner pleaded guilty last year to corruption charges related to his two terms in that office. As Kentucky Public Radio's Rick Hallett reports, it's been a dramatic fall from grace for Farmer, who parlayed his basketball fame into what was once a promising political career.
Second foul on Davis. Richie Farmer will go to the line where he's shooting 84%.
Richie Farmer became a basketball hero in high school, leading Eastern Kentucky's Clay County High to its first state title in 1987. At the University of Kentucky, he became one of the unforgettables. Four UK seniors who led the Wildcats to the brink of the 1992 Final Four in this game against Duke.
Southern accent. I've been a big blue fan from birth.
Their jerseys, including Farmer's number 32, hang from the rafters of Rupp Arena. Farmer's popularity was still strong in 2003 when he was elected Agriculture Commissioner, and 4 years later when the Republican was re-elected, the top vote-getter on the constitutional office ballot. That led to talk of aspirations for higher office.
David Williams and Richie Farmer, bold conservative leadership.
On May 17th, I'd be honored to have your vote.
In 2010, then Kentucky Senate President David Williams hoped Farmer's standing with voters would help him in his bid to unseat Democratic Governor Steve Beshear, and he tapped Farmer to be his running mate. In a stump speech at the Fancy Farm picnic, Farmer took a jab at Beshear's running mate, former Louisville Mayor Jerry Abramson.
Some folks did pretty well while he was mayor. One of his friends even got a no-show job for $85,000 a year. That's pretty good work if you can get it.
But things weren't going well for the campaign or for Farmer. His wife of 13 years filed for divorce shortly after the campaign was launched, and there was talk surfacing of financial abuses and other problems in the Agriculture Department under Farmer's watch. Williams and Farmer were defeated in a landslide in the 2011 general election. Kentuckians also elected a new agriculture commissioner that year, and one of Republican James Comer's first acts was to request an audit of the department under Farmer's administration. The results of that review were announced by Auditor Adam Edelin in the spring of 2012. Edelin said the dozens of abuses he uncovered, as he put it, shocked the conscience. It alleged that Farmer hired friends who apparently did little or no work and used state employees to perform personal errands.
He reportedly shot a deer illegally from the cab of a state-issued vehicle and then directed the state employee to field dress it for him.
Last year, Farmer was indicted on federal criminal charges of misusing state funds and using his position for personal gain. As part of a plea agreement that also settled state charges, Farmer will serve 27 months in prison and will have to pay tens of thousands of dollars in restitution. Farmer hasn't said much publicly about his case, but he apologized in court and after his sentencing.
I want to say to the people of the state how sorry that I am and how much they've meant to me, and thank them for all the understanding. And, you make bad decisions, poor judgments, and, you own up to those mistakes and you move on. And that's what I would hope that the people of the state will be willing to do.
Joshua Lars Wheel wrote about Richie Farmer's basketball and political careers in an online piece called The Legend of Richie Farmer, published by Yahoo Sports. Wheel, a Kentucky native and UK alumna, says he agrees with those who contend that despite his mistakes, Farmer's jersey should remain in the rafters of Rupp Arena.
I don't see any reason that his basketball career and his time at UK should be tarnished by anything that happened politically or personally later. That seems punitive to me in a way that doesn't really make any sense.
There's no parole in the federal court system, but Richie Farmer could have some prison time shaved off for good behavior. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville.
Population declines in southern West Virginia counties have led to an overall drop in the state's population last year. Estimates released Thursday by the U.S. Census Bureau showed Monongalia County, home to West Virginia University, had the largest gain of about 1,700 people. Most of those gains involved people coming from out of state. The report found that 41 counties lost population and 14 gained. 8 of the 10 counties that lost the most population were in southern West Virginia, led by Kanawha and McDowell. The eastern panhandle counties of Berkeley, Jefferson, and Morgan also saw growth. Cabell and Putnam counties were the only two gaining population in southern West Virginia. Overall, West Virginia's population fell nearly 2,400 last year. The state has about 1.8 million residents. All the cold and snow this winter has meant a great season for American skiers and ski resorts. Several resorts in the region have been able to remain open until the end of March, thanks to the colder-than-normal temperatures and extra snowfall. But as the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports, in Pennsylvania, the future of skiing is not so rosy. Climate scientists predict half of the PA resorts could be forced to close in the coming decades.
It's a little rainy, despite the cold wind blowing at the Blue Knob Mountain Resort in Claysburg, east of Johnstown. Rocky Sproul is right at home. He grew up skiing Blue Knob and still lives just over the ridge.
Actually, my dad worked here, ran the ski school desk for years.
Really?
Yeah. So.
Now Sproul is a retired school teacher and a part-time ski instructor. His bright red cheeks and friendly smile make him a favorite at Blue Knob. He jumps off the ski lift, ending his lesson with a young girl, and heads out to the expert trails to enjoy the view, the quiet, and a vertical drop he says will curl your hair.
Can you see the valley floor? Yeah, and it's straight pitch from here to there. It's all soft bumps right now. You can see how soft the snow is.
It's midweek and the slopes look sparse. There aren't many skiers or lines at the lifts. The early season around Christmas time started slow at Blue Knob and elsewhere in the region. But Sproul says cold and snow the rest of the winter have actually made for a good ski season at Blue Knob.
This has been a great winter, all in all, for Western Pennsylvania.
That hasn't been the case in many recent years, particularly the winter of 2011-12, one of the warmest on records. Kids were in t-shirts, not thinking about ski slopes. Blue Knob owner Rich Gauthier says they lost more than $150,000 that season. Some bigger resorts lost much more, in the millions. Gauthier says winters like that are one reason he spent more than $1 million on snowmaking equipment.
Everybody has to make snow nowadays. Even out west in the Rockies, they're making snow at the lower level. You can't count on Mother Nature to do it for you.
But Mother Nature doesn't always allow humans to work around her either. Snow, natural or man-made, doesn't hold if temperatures aren't low enough. It's got to stay below freezing at night to maintain the cover.
Yeah, no. Well, that's the bottom line for our model.
Daniel Scott is director of the Interdisciplinary Center on Climate Change at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. His team has published predictions for the ski industry based on what's happened in past warm winters.
Whenever we've talked to the ski industry, they tell us, don't tell me how much snow is going to fall. I don't care. Tell me how cold it's going to be and can I make enough snow? And that's what our model does.
To be considered economically viable, a ski resort has to be open at least 100 days per season. That means it needs to be below freezing temperatures long enough to maintain snow cover for 100 days. Scott's team modeled climate predictions separately for eastern and western Pennsylvania, and they looked at different scenarios, if greenhouse gas emissions were at low levels or at high levels. Across the state and at both emission scenarios, they predict a loss of 15 to 20% of the ski season over the next couple of decades. Scott says that's not too bad.
By mid-century, I would think most of your ski areas with advanced snowmaking would still have a good chance of being in operation.
Scott says some states, such as Connecticut, will lose all of their ski resorts, while Vermont will likely maintain all of its skiing. But Pennsylvania is right on the bubble of that 100-day season. He says a key factor will be getting cold weather early enough. Many ski resorts depend on being open for Christmas and New Year's, but they need cold enough temperatures for the snow to stick. This year in Pennsylvania, it rained during that holiday week, but otherwise it's been a cold, dry winter, and that's kept the slopes in good shape. But if greenhouse gas emissions continue at higher levels, Scott doesn't think PA ski resorts will make it past the year 2070.
Later century, particularly under the warmer scenarios, now you're looking at a 50% loss in your ski season, so that's no longer sustainable at that level.
The Union of Concerned Scientists says under similar models, the closest major ski resort to Philadelphia would be nearly 300 miles. Pittsburghers would have to drive 500 miles to go skiing. At Blue Knob, which is just a couple of hours from Pittsburgh, owner Rich Gauthier doesn't give long-term predictions like this much credence.
It's kind of like the weather people. You know, how nice is it to be able to get paid and be wrong? I mean, that probably drives me crazy more than anything. I always say that if you want the weather, if you don't like the weather on one report, just turn to another one because you'll get it different and you keep going until you find the one you like.
Researcher Daniel Scott doesn't dispute these kinds of comments.
They're exactly right. You know, it's variable year to year. That's what weather brings. And what we would expect is just we would get more of those warm years over time. And so by the 2050s, what we're considering to be a record warm year now would actually be sort of a fairly average winter then.
Scott says the problem for many resort businesses is that they can't sustain the lost revenue of even two warm winters in a row. But Scott's climate models and others that look at Pennsylvania show that things don't have to go downhill for the state's ski industry. If the amount of greenhouse gases is reduced, they predict many more ski resorts could remain viable. Knowing that has politicized an industry known for its laid-back style. In recent years, skiing trade groups have been lobbying in Washington on various climate and energy bills. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. A popular winter activity in Alaska is the Iditarod. Referred to as the last great race on Earth, the annual long-distance sled dog race occurs in early March from Anchorage to Nome, just over 1,000 miles. Mushers and a team of 16 dogs cover the distance in about a fortnight. But there's another event, the Iditarod Trail Invitational, which covers the same route, but by foot, bike, or ski. This year, a Tucker County, West Virginia resident won the race on foot. West Virginia Public Radio's Glennis Board reports.
The Iditarod Trail Invitational started off February 23rd. 23 days and 23 hours later, John Loger from Tucker County made it to Nome, Alaska. Dr. Loger is an emergency room physician who works in Randolph County. He's part of a subculture of extreme ultra-athletes who do crazy things like race really long distances in difficult conditions. He says he doesn't really remember when or how he became interested in the Iditarod, but last year he ran the qualifying 350-mile event. And this year, after applying and being accepted to race the 1,000-mile event, he paid the $1,200 fee, took some time off from the emergency room, and headed to Alaska.
For me, it's a lifestyle of just activity. I don't have a training program. I don't have a regimen. I don't have a diet. I attempt to be active every day and do something every day.
He says he spends a lot of time bicycling year-round through Tucker County. I told him that was hard to imagine. Steep slopes, dicey roads. Not a lot of people are regularly biking through and around Tucker County, no matter the weather.
So it's perfect for training. It's perfect. There's not a lot of other people out there, so you're alone a lot. And there's variable conditions that are not always the easiest to recreate in. So snow, rain, cold, wind, all that is in abundance up here. So it's a good training ground.
Loger says the rolling hill landscape of the coastal portion of his trip reminded him a lot of West Virginia. He said it was one of his favorite parts. But, you know, covering 1,000 miles is like driving from Morgantown to Naples, Florida, in a car that takes about 18 hours. He says when you cover that kind of area, you're bound to run through a variety of landscapes.
We start on essentially the South Central Alaska and trail that is fairly well marked and used as a inter-village highway, so to speak. I mean, the villages use this trail as a way to get between their towns in the winter, and it's also being used by the sled dogs for the Iditarod. The weather, the conditions, the villages, the people, everything changes throughout the course. Different cultures as you move your way through. You kind of have your South Central Alaska, you have your interior, you have your Yukon, you do your land portage into the coast. And then from the coast, it's between villages, and you have the ocean on one side and land on the other, and you pretty much work your way from a town called Unalakleet all the way up to Nome.
It took him 23 days, 23 hours, and 10 minutes. Loger says 18 to 20 hours each day he was moving, stopping for about 3 or 4 hours to sleep and to maintain. He slept outside mostly, showered twice. He would be offered meals throughout the trip, but for the most part, he ate along the way. He carried about 3 days' worth of food at a time, collecting it as he traveled from post office that he sent packages to beforehand.
Because I was kind of out there at the same time as the dog sleds teams, and there's a lot of checkpoints for them. And so if I was going through a checkpoint, just they would invite me in for food. It's pretty nice. It's pretty sweet, actually. Great people. I've had a lot of trail angels help me out. So that would be the meal. Everything else would be candy bars. I ate a lot of the commercialized MRE-type foods. I had some, you know, jelly bean stuff, almonds, peanuts, and then water. And that was about it.
There were seven who started the foot race.
Five of us made it to Nome. I was the first person to get to Nome. But we don't really care. Winning is finishing.
Loger says for the most part he enjoyed himself, but there were some stumbling blocks.
Yes, I was unfortunate enough to have pretty severe diarrhea for the last 5 days. It was horrible.
Good thing he's a doctor, right? And what did he prescribe for himself? What's the secret of champions that allowed him to persevere, to be the first to the finish line?
I doubled my water intake, and I had 75 miles to go, and they had a little store there, and I asked the guy at the house I was at, I was like, man, you guys have Laffy Taffy? I had a bar of Laffy Taffy from somewhere earlier in the trip, and it tasted good, and I was like, I want Laffy Taffy, and he went and bought me, oh gosh, I gave him $100, $100 probably worth of Laffy Taffy, and it was, and a bit of honey, and that's what worked for me. Great Laffy Taffy the whole way. Yeah.
Yeah. The takeaway, Loger says first and foremost, the race taught him a lot about management. He said that was the recurring theme. But he says he also learned a lot about what it means to be selfish.
I'm gone for a month, and, you know, I'm thinking only about myself and some very basic needs for myself. So it's pretty selfish. And that was hard to deal with, realizing that. And it's only possible because of my wife, Jody. And that's it. This would not be something I could do without her giving me the go-ahead. So it's her fault. It's her fault that I do this.
Well, for winning first place, Loger didn't receive any medal or ceremony or trophy. Just love and admiration from his community and free entry into next year's race. He says he might just have to do it again. But if he does, he'll likely race on a bike. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Cabell County, West Virginia officials are excited about a new school they hope will set an example for others around the state. West Virginia Public Radio's Clark Davis reports on the development of an incubator school through a waiver attained with an Innovation Zone grant.
What's one way I can get your attention, Jason?
A new school will open in the fall of 2015 in Huntington that Cabell County School Board officials hope is the next step in education. It will be a consolidation of Peyton Elementary and Geneva Kinn Elementary in the east end of Huntington. They'll use the former Beverly Hills Middle School facility that was vacated in December for a brand new Huntington East Middle School. Cabell Superintendent William Smith is excited about the possibilities.
What you should see in a classroom like this is more student engagement, a high level of student engagement. You'll see teachers, of course, present lessons and that type of thing too, but you'll see more and more of the student grappling with the information and solving the problems.
So,
why is Smith excited? Smith says it's because it'll be the first expeditionary learning school in the state, known as EL for short. Students will learn about completing projects that will stretch across different subject areas and can sometimes take the entire school year. Smith visited a school in Chicago that he says is the example he wants to follow.
I had a chance to see presentations from students from Chicago in a very, very difficult part of town who have risen above all of that and have such poise and confidence and approach to learning. It just blows your socks off when you see it. This is what we want our students to look like.
There you go.
Smith says the different learning environment focuses on those interactions between students and teachers that create a learning atmosphere that is conducive to changing the outlook of life for students. The Cabell Board has made trips to EL schools in Chicago, Denver, and Asheville, North Carolina, Smith says the two schools have a large number of children growing up in poverty. He says they were looking for ways to help those kids and thought the best way to do that might be to try something unheard of in the state.
This we saw as an effective way of approaching that, where the students are getting and teachers are actually able to talk about their practice in order to improve. And so the school actually becomes alive and evolving rather than just a stagnant, we've trained teachers, this is what you do.
They describe the school as an incubator school because of the experimental learning environment. They hope that what they learn from the experiment leads to others around the state doing their own experiments and developing expeditionary learning environments of their own. Cabell County Schools will team with the Harless Center at Marshall University to study how educational concepts are working and what the next step might be to continue the growth that will take place in the classroom. Ryan McKenzie is the principal of Peyton Elementary. He'll be the new principal of the developed school. He says the work students do here will be beneficial to the community.
The kids will be engaged in learning that is real out in their communities, out in the real world. They'll be doing, you know, water analysis projects, for example, in your community and sending that report off to the mayor's office or the commission.
So remember,
the board will depend on McKenzie and the teachers to relay and adjust how the learning environment is working. Michelle Goodson is a fourth grade teacher at Geneva Kent Elementary and has been assigned to the new school.
I am really excited to go to the EL school because it is exactly the way I teach. It's what I love about teaching, hands-on, project-based, and to extend that into expeditions is going to be even more exciting.
The school will work with a mentor school that's already been through the program that will help them adjust and determine what is and isn't working.
It is a better way to make them think and process what we're teaching them.
Amanda Ottaviano is a third grade teacher from Geneva Kent and will join Goodson at the incubator school.
I think that the new school will create culture, not only in our schools with our kids, but I think that it'll create kind of a different culture in the community with lots of parent involvement. And so hopefully that will impact everyone.
Renovation will begin soon on Beverly Hills Middle to turn it into the new incubator school. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
A bill to insert more exercise into the school day failed to pass the West Virginia legislature this year. The Move to Improve Act would have required schools to incorporate a set amount of moderate to vigorous activity in the school day. But as West Virginia Public Radio's Jessica Lilly reports, even without the requirement, some schools are getting students out of their seats and moving.
Children and teens spend more than half of their waking hours at school. Edward Evans teaches in McDowell County, where, according to data compiled in county health rankings and roadmaps, 44% of adults age 20 and over report no leisure time of physical activity.
We're seeing kids that go straight from here, sitting all day in a classroom, straight home, and then getting on the computer and sitting there for hours.
About 33% of children aged 10 to 17 in the state are overweight or obese, according to a national survey taken between 2011 and 2012.
Kids that sit in the chair all day long are going to get tired and listless and sleepy. And I mean, every teacher in America encounters kids that fall asleep because they may not have gotten enough sleep the night before, and here they are doing something that is not exciting them and they're not moving.
In elementary school, some teachers say the transition would be simple.
Class, your turn. Word.
Bottle.
Spell bottle.
B-O-T-T-L-E.
What's your word?
Bottle.
Like in this classroom where children are touching their head, shoulders, knees, and toes with each letter.
Word.
Maybe.
Word.
Mercer County kindergarten teacher Billy Wood says she already uses movement in her lessons, and it's the way to go.
We put motions to songs. We'll do Vimeo with the smart board where they actually get up and move and jump and dance and sing along with it. And it's surprising how fast they learn.
Wood says she also uses old-time records like Whip Hep Palmer.
Where'd you rather shoot? Got the hurry, got the worry blues. I can't keep cool when I'm keyed up. Now where'd I leave my coffee cup? Tommy, that's not your toothbrush. So how I hate this nervous rush.
To help children in her classroom move to the education beat. And she often joins them in the dance.
The primary years are the most important in order to get your mind and your coordination. And it helps with fine motor skills, gross motor skills, and they have to see how it works together.
Still, a lack of resources, pressure to increase test scores, and even age creates challenges. Elementary students are generally easier to motivate with physical activity during a lesson than, say, a middle school or high school student. But science teacher Edward Evans is finding a way. His students keep moving, frequently walking around to different stations for lab.
Is it challenging? Yeah. Is it doable? Absolutely. It's just a matter of creative scheduling. We work the time into the schedule.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly.
No, come on, Freddy. 7:45 and you're still not ready. Where's your homework? Where's your lunch? Got a lead bowl of crispy crunch. Got to hurry, got to worry blues. Wash your hands, comb your hair. School bells ringing and you're not there. Got to hurry, got to worry blues. Button your coat and do it quick. Drink your juice or you'll get sick. Clear your plate, scrub your face. I swear you're moving at a turtle's pace. My heart is beating double time. My thoughts are freaking in my mind. Got to hurry, got to worry blues. Dibbity-dash, lickety-split, zibbity-zoom, diddy-dip. Razzmatazz, frazzly-frazz, skiddly-daddle and all that jazz. My hands are shaking, my legs are itching, my pits are sweating, my nose is twitching. Got to hurry, got to worry blues.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia, I'm Cecilia Mason. Ashland, Kentucky's Highlands Museum and Discovery Center is starting a new program to emphasize the community's heritage in country and bluegrass music. Beginning in April, Director Carol Allen says the Highlands will open its doors one night each month for local musicians and their fans.
We do have a wonderful Country Music Highway Heritage Hall. And in that, of course, are several of the people, Keith Whitley, the Judds, Billy Ray Cyrus, and on and on. And we need to capitalize on that and give people a place to come to hear bluegrass and classic country music.
Allen says the first program will be April 3rd from 7 to 9 in the evening. The West Virginia State Fair is looking for the best pie makers in the state. Bakers receiving the most votes from each county will be invited to the bake-off in August at the State Fair. Nominations on the county level are being accepted until May 14th on the State Fair's website. Prizes include $150 in a State Fair pie dish for first place, $100 for second place, and $50 for third place. Joe Riley grew up in a farming family in Stomping Creek, West Virginia. After graduating from West Virginia University, Joe became a high school ag teacher and taught for 17 years before becoming principal of Marlinton Middle School. While continuing to work full-time, Joe and his family managed to run their farm in Stomping Creek. In exploring the history and heritage of agriculture in Pocahontas County, the Traveling 219 Project sat down and talked with Joe about his own experience as a farmer here in the rural Allegheny Mountains.
I can remember going to the stockyards as a kid and sitting in line and waiting and waiting and waiting to unload because there were so many calves going through the market. And now if you have to wait a half an hour, it's like, gosh, long line, and it used to be hours you'd have to sit in line. I'm Joe Riley, and I'm a part-time farmer, and me and my family run and operate Stomping Creek Farm in the southern end of Pocahontas County. Been involved with it all my life. Whenever I was a kid, Dad had this farm, and so I always grew up on a farm, and pretty much it's been this farm that we're here at now. This is a farm I grew up on, so I've been around sheep, I've been around cattle all my life, and the farm machinery and the making the hay and the harvesting the crops, so it's just something that I really like, and it's something that I've continued to do. Right now I'm the principal of Marlinton Middle School, so it's changed what I do drastically because with the farming and with being the principal of a school, it's really hard to find enough time in the day to do both. So I end up getting up about 5:30 in the morning. I do all my feeding, all my cattle, all my sheep before school, then setting in school at 7:30 in the morning. Some of the biggest changes I've seen is just the amount of livestock you have to have in order to make it profitable. Before, there were a lot of small farmers. Whenever I was growing up as a kid, there were a lot. But now there's less and less of the small farmers, and more of them's just getting bigger and bigger just to keep up. Whenever I was a kid, we made all square bales of hay, and we baled hay with a 35 horsepower tractor, and that was as big as you needed. But now it seems like the price of machinery has gotten so high, and just even finding labor. I mean, before you could call almost any day and get somebody to help you in the hayfield throwing square bales, and you just can't do that now. With the price of labor, plus also it just doesn't seem like some of the younger generations want to work in that hayfield because it's hot and it's hard work. If people are thinking about global impact and, you know, how can we reduce our emissions and all that, well, if we can do it locally and we can raise food, why not keep our money here in this community, in this economy, and let people make a living doing it? So, you know, the person that wants to put up a high tunnel and raise lettuce, you know, instead of us going to the grocery store and getting what's coming out of California, why not purchase it here in Pocahontas County so one more person can stay and make a living here, because we're going to use it no matter where it's going to come from. So I think it's really important that people realize where their food's coming from. But, you know, the other thing is, too, like whenever I go to the farmer's market, you know, I charge $5 a pound for ground beef. And, you know, a lot of people come by, well, you know, that's expensive. I can go to Foodland and get it for $2.98. Well, that's true. So people sometimes are more worried about the cost, and, you know, there's not a lot of free money around here. So it's whether or not they can even afford it. But then from the aspect of being an ag teacher is, well, anybody that has 5 acres can grow their own beef, you know, buy a calf and get your fence up. And, you know, once you build that fence, it's 20 years worth of fence, and you can get you a beef, and you can get you a pig, and you can get you some chickens and grow a garden. But I reckon that's what you know how to do and what you're used to. I wish I could just be a farmer. And it's hard. It's not impossible. You can do it, but it would definitely be a lifestyle change. And like I said, I've got 9 more years that I got to put in the school system, and I can retire. And I can retire at 55, so I still got time to be a full-time farmer.
This story was produced by Dan Schultz and Jesse Wright Mendoza of the Traveling 219 Project, a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio, with support from the West Virginia Humanities Council, AmeriCorps Vista, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Visit traveling219.com or Facebook. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.